Meet and Three is back. We're kicking off our fourth season and celebrating HRN's 10th anniversary with a very special episode about our home, Brooklyn.
Roberta's was such an interesting place with such a strong gravitational pull. It attracted all these different groups.
The neighborhood has changed a lot over the past decade, from its culinary renaissance to the complicated implications of gentrification.
I would say the majority of the people who are members of our co-op definitely have a certain purchasing power, are mostly white, and we are trying to change that.
We're taking you on a journey that spans the birthplace of food radio to buzzy neighborhood pollinators to the transformative health journey of our borough president.
That was my moment of, you know, wow, someone has thrown me a life raft and I'm going to take it.
Subscribe to Meet and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Escape Makers' first-of-its-kind virtual agritourism conference. For more information, go to escapemaker.biz. That's escapemaker.biz.
Hello, this is Lisa Held coming to you live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and you're listening to The Farm Report, a Heritage Radio Network show about the people, processes, and policies that shape how food is produced today. Today I'm here with Tom Gamble, the owner and farmer from Gamble Family Vineyards in the Napa Valley. Tom, thank you so much for being here.
It's great to see the other side of the continent.
I mean, is it like fun to leave Napa to come to New York City?
Oh, it is. I mean, you gotta keep your mind expanded, man.
Have you always been in that area?
Yes, I was born and raised in Napa Valley, and I'm a third generation Napa Valley kid. My grandfather first came to the Valley around 1916.
Wow. And you were born on a farm, is that right?
Well, my mom made it to the hospital, but...
yeah. Details.
Barely. But I've lived all my life on a farm, except for some detours during college.
Okay. So what kind of farm, when you were a kid, what kind of farm did your parents have?
Well, it was really different in the Napa Valley back then. So we're talking... the 1960s. Mm-hmm. And grapes were not the primary agricultural crop. Actually, the number one crop in 1961 was beef cattle.
Huh.
And then there was, so livestock really, beef, dairy, and then tree crops were like prunes and walnuts were the top crops in Napa Valley, followed by grapes. And so the wine industry was really in a nascent position back then. Hmm. So the first decade of my life, it was just spent moving irrigation pipe and being around livestock and wild animals.
Hmm. So what changed in Napa? Like, what led to the region becoming so much of a grape-growing region?
Economics necessity, but it was also a passion, the passion of a community to stay in agriculture. We had seen what had happened to what we now call Silicon Valley. It was the Santa Clara Valley, the most fertile farmland in California, which has lots of fertile farmland, so that's quite the statement. And a lot of things happened starting in 1958 when a regional government said that Napa County must have 1 million people living in it by the year 1980. And people didn't like that. Some traction started to happen to challenge it, but it didn't really gain a lot of steam until 1966. When they changed, the state changed the way properties were taxed. Developers had not been able to force farmers to sell so they could build more buildings and pave stuff over. And so under the guise of some sort of progressive idea, they decided that you should pay property taxes based upon the highest and best use, or the most intensive use, which is always paving something over. You can always make more money building high-rises than farming, even grapes.
Right.
But so they passed that law, but some smart guy had put a little time bomb in there, and it said, well, if you have an agricultural zoning district, you can then tax at the value of the product coming off the property, and basically keep the old tax rate. It didn't quite work out that way, but that's what happened. So some Dorothy Erskine was a lady who had witnessed the urbanization of the San Francisco Peninsula, and she had moved up there. So she rallied farmers, she rallied my mom, she rallied legislators. There was a big fight, but in the end, in 1968, the Ag Preserve was formed by a unanimous vote of the County Board of Supervisors. So we created the first agricultural preserve in the Napa Valley. And that gave us time to create a successful wine industry. Without that, I do not know that we would have been successful. I think that the development pressures would have been too hard, and we might have a little vineyard here or there, but it wouldn't be the Napa Valley that we know today.
Right. I mean, that's so interesting. I didn't really know that history at all. But so the Napa Valley Agricultural Preserve, that applies to any kind of agriculture, right?
Oh yeah. You could, and you could still have livestock. There's still some, specialty farms in Napa. In fact, they're growing on a small scale, but they are definitely growing. And there are definitely restaurant gardens being grown, and some heritage fig trees, for example. And we had a small truck farm for the local, and a box program back in the 80s. And but then we just had to focus on the grapes ultimately.
Right.
So it exists, but it comes down to economics, and everything's really, really expensive in California, and particularly in Napa Valley, and so grapes have been dominant. Now we're going to have something that was just legalized in California. There's going to be some regulations that allow a very small amount of cannabis to be grown. That hasn't taken effect yet, and I don't know when it will. But I don't see it overcoming grapes. It'll just be a nice thing to help diversify agriculture.
Right.
Another thing that people don't know about Napa is it's about 500,000 acres, but just less than 50,000 acres are planted in grapes. The rest is watershed and open space. At least 100,000, I think it's more, is permanently protected open water space, open space and watershed. And then the rest is rangeland, and there is a growing specialty livestock program too. That's really going to be the future for the rest of the valley, I think, where it's not great growing land, but it's great grazing land.
Right. Well, and I mean, everything that you just said just made me think, you know, I love wine, and I'm so glad that you're growing grapes and making wine. To be clear, I'm going to up front say that. But it's kind of crazy. So this agricultural preserve was established, but what you're saying is the economics still don't make sense to grow food, essentially, to raise. It's way easier to make money growing grapes and making wine. And so a lot of people switch to that from livestock. And so that's kind of a crazy thing when you think about it, right?
I don't know if it's crazy. Wine is an agricultural product. It's not something you eat, but it's something that complements a life, and it keeps farmers in farming.
Right.
And who knows what will happen. There was a grape and wine industry boom in the 19th century. And then with phylloxera, it went out of vogue. And other agricultural products came in. And then there was another, in the very late 19th century and early 20th century, there was another wine boom. And in fact, there are warehouses here in Brooklyn just for receiving bulk wine from Napa Valley. Hmm. And then the prohibition came, and then other agriculture came in. But if you want to, moving forward, if you want to preserve the land, there has to be some sort of sustainability. And it's and I go back to the three P's, the people, planet, and profits. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to continue to reinvest in the land, and you can't do that if you're not making any money.
Right.
But if you get too greedy and you're taking too much money and you're not reinvesting it in the land, then the planet suffers.
Right.
And it's not necessarily cool for the people or that are your neighbors.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that question of why it's not economically feasible to raise livestock is a whole other one that we would have to have a whole other show for.
that is a world that's going to change radically in the next 20 years.
Yeah, absolutely. So in your trajectory, so you were growing up on a farm. When did you personally get into growing grapes?
Let me see. As a kid, I was messing around in the vineyards, and I certainly harvested a lot of grapes when I was a little kid. And my mom said sometimes my diapers would be full of grapes. so maybe that's too much information, but because there were little plots of vineyards around where we were, and I guess professionally, I started harvesting grapes in about 81, the early 80s, because when I was still going to UC Davis, I started a farming company, and a few of us were able to scratch up just enough money to buy this messed up hops field that had been abandoned, because hops, and this was in Sonoma County, and hops used to be really big in Sonoma County, and so we cleared out all the hop trellises and ultimately planted Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, and this was in the Russian River Valley. So that was my first professional farming venture, and doing something outside the family ag business.
Okay, and then when did you move to Gamble? When did Gamble actually launch?
Well, I've been farming grapes since the early 80s, and then I added the wine portfolio for sustainability reasons and some passion for it in 2000, and I was looking at the trajectory of land prices, and I'm thinking, well, I can be very comfortable, and Colette can be very, that's my wife, can be very comfortable growing grapes, but if something goes south, the grape market, while it's very valuable, is also cyclical.
Right.
And so And the kids were coming along, my nieces and nephews, and they, some of them thought tractors were cool, but others did not. But they all seemed to find, especially as they've gotten older, seemed to find that wine and the wine business may attract them more, because there's more things you can do versus physically make the wine or physically pick the grapes. And so I guess I'm getting ahead of myself in that story. So I was looking at the sustainability of owning the land through thick and thin and vertical integration, and trying to bring a product to market would help us put another leg on the stool of sustainability, at least on the economic side.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the adventure I've been on since 2000. And then we started with some partners, and then Colette and I went out on our own in 2005.
Mm. So I read that you say you're a farmer first. Mm-hmm. Do you also make the wine?
No, I'm on the Farmer 12-Step program. I'm learning, I've admitted a problem. I'm learning to delegate. So I do have a winemaker. His name's Jim Close. He comes from an urban environment called London. And he trained in France, and we have kind of the same outlook on how we want our wines to taste, and that they need to be varietally distinct and talk about the place they come from. And so we hit it off, and he's made every bottle.
Amazing. So what does the vineyard look like now? Like, what are you growing? What kind of wines are you making?
Oh, what kind of grapes are we growing? Well, we grow Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, Petit Verdot, Petit Syrah. I have a few vines of Syrah left. And then Sauvignon Blanc is the only white variety that I'm currently growing. The vineyards are, we now have 175 acres that we farm outside the legacy piece that I grew up on. That's leased out these days, which is a story in itself. So we grow those grapes. We sell most of those grapes. So we're I would say, a medium-sized farmer and a small winemaker. So it's another leg of sustainability where I forgot to go to Wall Street or Silicon Valley and
me too
making a killing. But we're loving life though, huh?
Right.
So I'm able to sell grapes and keep the cash flow growing and keep making wine is a capital intensive project, and that cash flow helps me continue to build a sustainable brand. If I was in it for the short term and not thinking seven generations down the line, maybe I'm not thinking quite that far, but that's the idea. And I would be doing things way differently just to jack up returns early versus trying to build a sustainable return.
Right. What about challenges that you face as a grape farmer in Napa? What are some of the biggest ones? And I mean, we're talking a lot about economics, but I'm kind of interested too in just the actual challenges of farming there, like, you know, water potentially, or sort of the logistical challenges.
We are blessed in Napa, and I would say Sonoma too, that to be in one of the sweet spots of the world for growing grapes. And in a way, it has the least number of environmental challenges. I was extremely fortunate to work a little bit in Italy and France and in their great wine growing regions, and they have more environmental challenges, weather challenges.
Okay.
I'm not going to say environmental. And so the challenges that we have, grapes are a drought-tolerant crop. They don't need a lot of water. When we were growing hay crops in the 60s, alfalfa can use 3 acre-feet of water per acre. We, at the most, and most of the water would be used for frost protection, and would be about a quarter of an acre foot. And it's more like, and I would say that water usage is more like one-tenth of an acre foot. So extremely small. And we're becoming more and more sophisticated with our rootstocks that, and you need the rootstock because of the underground bugs that will eat the vinifera. Grapevine, phylloxera being the most famous. And so over the decades, I'm experimenting with some brand new stuff that's just coming out of UC Davis to further that. And too soon to tell the results. Some will work and some will, you know, I'll be hitting my forehead like Homer Simpson or something and saying, "Doh." And so anyway, that water, and we did something to make sure that water is a community resource, to make sure that one farmer didn't hog it all, or what we were really concerned about, because we are blessed with a good groundwater table that has been protected by some of our enlightened land use policies. We went even further and said, you can only use 1 acre foot per acre per year maximum, way more than we need. And then you cannot sell that groundwater. So we took the economic incentive of people saying, oh, it's easier just to sell the water off. And so that has worked extremely well, not perfectly. There are some more droughty areas and with less of a water table. But for the most part, Napa Valley's main aquifer is in extremely good shape. And it's because of some enlightened policies that were passed. So water isn't the biggest issue. Now, if you're that one place that has a problem, you would disagree with me. But I'm talking as a community at large. And then frost protection is, frost is one of the weather things we have to watch out for. And so the buds come out in the springtime, and then you can have a cold snap, and that can hit the buds and reduce your crop for the season significantly so. And by either freezing the bud off or burning it, or by weakening that bud enough and the baby fruit inside, that it shatters when it's older. And so to combat that, we have wind machines and to stir the air to keep it moving.
Interesting.
So that works in most cases. In fact, more people are going are reinstalling wind machines, and they're not very loud, used World War II airplane motors anymore. They're very relatively quiet. They run on propane versus diesel, and there's also some solar components to the newer ones down to keep the batteries charged. And there's also, and then that'll work down to about 28 degrees, and then you go to water your sprinklers. But more and more people don't want, especially in the later season like now, don't want to use water for frost protection unless they absolutely have to.
How does water provide frost protection?
That is a very, very good question, and it's counterintuitive.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to make any sense.
Okay, so how does the stereotype of an Eskimo stay warm? They build ice around them and make an igloo. So the water freezes at 32 degrees, and then inside it's an insulator, and so it's staying at 32 degrees, and then the actual process of freezing and thawing creates BTUs in them in itself of that process. So we have little igloos around our baby grapes.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much wine somebody drank to figure that one out.
Right.
They're the ones on the that got passing grades in college.
Okay, well, on that note, we actually need to take a quick break for a word from a sponsor. When we come back, I want to ask you a little bit more about these enlightened land use policies that you're talking about.
Cool.
We'll be right back.
This episode is brought to you by Escape Makers' first-of-its-kind virtual agritourism conference. Did you know that every $1 invested in tourism marketing returns on average $3 to $8 back? Not a bad ROI. Learn how to grow your agritourism business via 12 workshops entirely women-led. The local travel landscape is rapidly changing to meet the demands of the leisure, event, and corporate travel sectors. Whether you're a farmer or producer, a winemaker, a restaurateur, or a destination marketing organization, there's more opportunity than ever to capture these markets. The Virtual Agritourism Conference will provide you with insights and skills to keep your target demographic coming back for more. 14 speakers providing 6+ hours of education that you can watch at your convenience anytime on any device. Maximize your time, budget, and resources, and focus on creative solutions to help your business thrive. Presented by Escape Maker and Fulton Stahl Market, the full conference access pass is now available for purchase. Use the code HERITAGE2019 for $50 off a full pass at checkout. For more information and to purchase your pass, go to escapemaker.biz. That's escapemaker.biz.
All All right, we're back. This is Lisa Held. You're listening to The Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here with Tom Gamble from Gamble Family Vineyards. We've been talking about all kinds of things related to farming and wine, which is really fun. You know, I just to put that out there, you know, I did mention I liked wine earlier, and we don't get to talk about wine much on the Farm Report. So it's a nice change of pace for sure.
It's still farming and you're still producing a product and you have all the same land use issues and concerns and of any other crop.
Well, and I think that's actually why I was excited to have you on, because it's maybe something you think when people drink it, you think less about where it came from or how it was produced, because it doesn't feel as much like an agricultural product for some reason, you know, maybe. I don't know. I think people think more about, oh, I should know how my food was produced, but maybe don't.
Yeah, I thought that's what this whole show was about.
Right, exactly.
So let's get schooled.
So on that note, so you were talking a little bit of, before the break about some enlightened land use policies, you were calling them, which is a really interesting phrase in itself. I don't know if this is what you meant, but one thing I wanted to ask you about was the Napa Green Certified program. I think you were you involved in creating it? Is that right? Or
yes, I was sitting at the table when we began that effort for the Napa Green certification, and it's parallel certification, fish-friendly farming.
Oh, so those were created at the same time?
Fish-friendly farming came a little earlier, and the creative process behind fish-friendly actually started in the Sonoma-Mendocino area and then came to Napa. And there, just like there are various organic certifications, are these different these conservation certifications as well, and the genesis behind both of these were to go beyond organic and start thinking about your impacts off the farm, because organic, at least at the time, and still to a certain extent this day, doesn't take it quite to the level that these do. So you can see it almost as an add-on, if you would. And so, and I think that, and just like different organic certifications, you know, there's different administrations for both, and some people feel more comfortable with the vibe of one group of administrators than another. And the key is just to keep moving forward, keep making progress, because we got to go beyond sustainability, which I think I mentioned before, and talk about regeneration and regenerative ag. And that kind of stuff floats my boat. Otherwise, you're doing the same old thing all the time.
Right. Can you even, so when you say like it takes it off the farm more than something like organic does, what do you mean? Can you give me an example of that?
Yes, I can. So fish-friendly farming is and Napa Green, one of their biggest things is to think about what's happening to your waterways. And even if you don't have a stream bordering your particular farm, it's just like those little blue fish that are stenciled next to the storm drain in the cities. Everything leads to a body of water. So how do you keep even fine sediment? Even the most conscientious farmer can always try to figure out how to do better with keeping the sediment, hence his dirt, on his land. That's why you're seeing no-till ag become more and more prevalent, not only in the wine business and grape growing, but so one of the organic doesn't require permanent cover crop, but to be fish-friendly certified, that is one of the components, and Napa Green as well. And there are allowances and some flexibility for when you have to remove a vineyard, you may have to remove your permanent cover crop, but then you have to go back in almost immediately with a permanent cover crop. And there's a lot of cool things about permanent cover crop as you get to learn about it. It's an ecosystem of its own. It's creating, people drive through Napa Valley and might criticize, well, you've got a monoculture in Napa. And I would challenge that by saying, well, really, no, we don't. We only have 9 to 10% planted in grapes. And then you have the permanent cover crop. And the permanent cover crop is creating an ecosystem that's storing 1 to 2 tons of carbon per acre on top of the, I don't know, 5 to 7 more tons per acre for the vines. So then, and then there's the whole ecosystem from mycorrhiza that's growing on the roots, that's also very copacetic with the vines as well. And it's also competing a little bit with the vines. A certain amount of struggle makes for a better grape. And so you start from the microscopic, and then you end up even with more earthworms, more bugs, and hopefully good bugs, and all the way up to subterranean creatures like my frenemy, the gopher. And But then Napa Green and Fish Farm, they're also talking about habitat in and around the vineyard. So on the streams, there's a huge river restoration project in Napa going back, going back almost 20 years now. And so we have the most environmentally intact river system in the Bay Area, for sure. Hmm. And it is a wildlife corridor, and there's bobcats and mountain lions and bears in the further reaches. Well, there's a bobcat in my vineyard. She had 2 little babies.
Oh, my God.
Last year, yeah.
I don't know if you should tell people that. They might be scared.
No, they're cute. They're cute. If they growl at you, okay. Run away. Yeah, this is an oral show, but I have my trail cams caught the mom with the 2 babies. Wow. Running behind it. So yeah,
it's cute.
And the beavers have come back, and we planted all these trees, and then the beavers start chopping them down. So you're starting to think, well, how am I going to deal with this? Am I going to get Bill Murray on them? I can Caddyshack or something, but. No, you figure it out. The cool thing is you have these kind of problems versus having a denuded waterway.
Right.
You have stream banks eroding. You have invasive species moving in. So invasive species cleanup, getting back to the green cert and the fish friendly. Getting rid of invasive species, and planting natural species again, which happen for the most part, not always, to be better environment to grow grapes in, because they harbor fewer bad bugs than invasive species, and typically suck up less water. Hmm. And simple things like putting in raptor perches and owl boxes and birdhouses, simple little things like that, if you have an incentive for people to do it, like these certification programs, you can then start showing incremental change. And then you can educate the public that you're doing the right thing for the environment. You can educate the regulators, who love to see these group things happening, because everybody wants a cleaner world. And the debate is how you get there. Is it through regulation, or is it through incentive? And I don't know about you, but I don't like being told what to do. And so if you incentivize people and inspire them to do the right thing, and then you can work hand in hand with regulatory authorities and bring all the parties together. I mean, we're not all sitting around the campfire singing Kumbaya, but it's a great step forward to keep a good thing going and give back. Mm-hmm. Again, it comes down to that sustainability, and of you have to give back to the land to keep going, and then taking it to this, where we are now, to this regenerative thing.
Right.
The good ideas of the past, the green revolution, the first green revolution was actually the use of, it was post-World War II, and the use of all the nasty chemicals we're trying to get away from now.
Right. Yeah, I've actually, we were just talking about the green revolution here at HRN recently.
So,
I think there's maybe hopefully a little bit of a new one. That is.
Oh no, there's more than
a little bit different from the first one.
We're far along the path, and we're challenging ourselves. Like I did not use lightly, thinking beyond organic. Okay, how do we take the next step? And there's always going to be another step.
Right.
And how do we keep the critters happy? How do we keep the farmers happy? How do we keep our neighbors happy, the community at large that wants to share our bounty, but wants to share our bounty knowing that it's raised correctly and grown correctly. And that's always evolving. And especially since World War II, every generation has become more sophisticated and had a more creative palette than the previous generation. And so that's been an evolution that allows us to really do this.
Right. I want to go back for a second to the permanent cover crop thing.
Yeah,
it's just so fascinating to me. This might be kind of sound silly, but I'm trying to picture what you mean by permanent. So is it actually growing with the vines like year round? Yeah. So,
yeah. Huh. So you can have an annual cover crop and which might be, depending on what your soil needs, high in nitrogen or high in some sort of organic matter, but you till that in.
Right.
And tilling of soil is actually a sterilization of soil. And it also disrupts the gophers, runs and all that kind of stuff, at least for a little while. I keep coming back for that because I do have a little too much of a Caddyshack thing about gophers. But the permanent cover crop is also an ongoing experiment in what's right for the soils. I wouldn't say anything's, and planting something is always good, but then you start fine tuning it and you start geeking out over it. And what blend of grasses do I want? Do we need to have some clovers in this? My wife wants some pretty flowers as well, at least blooming for part of the season, and that's all cool. And then you go, and then maybe sometimes you do have to change it out because you've either taken down the vigor of the area too much, at least for the vines to grow, and it's too competitive, and so you have to rethink it, or you've planted something that everybody, including the smart kids at UC Davis, thought this is going to be a really good cover crop. But then it turns out there's a bug that's transmitting some disease that you never thought about. Mm. And so, okay, we can't use that plant anymore. And then so you're constantly thinking about it and changing it. And just like a permanent cover crop, like a lawn or a golf course or something, it has to be aerated every once in a while. So you have these little spiky things that you can wheel behind your tractor and aerate the soil a little bit. But the bottom line benefits are enormous. So just from the capture of fine sentiment to the amazing microbial wildlife that is starting, that can start to happen and help nourish your vines, and really a goal for us in the high end of the wine world, and that's where we have to be. We can't be Van Ordinaire because everything costs too much in Napa, and for quality, we want to keep our vines as healthy as possible and living as long as possible. And vines can live a super long time. I mean, they can live 100 years. Mm-hmm. And at some point in their lives, usually in their 20s, the vines are going to start dropping their yield. But if the quality stays up, then you will keep those vines in the ground. And if one or two vines die, then you replace them. It's better to replace vines one by one than having a wholesale replant. But if you're a big commercial operation, the economic imperative is to rip everything out between 20 and 30 and start all over again. Mm. But if you can start, and I'm not the only guy, but we touch our vines probably 11 times by hand every year. So that's, and it's consolidated in certain months, but that's a pass almost every month to touch the vines, to take care of them. And you start understanding the peculiarities of if not every vine, then a group of vines.
Yeah.
And the more difficult the site, the more the more struggles a vine may have, and so we give them a lot of TLC. So when you see the price of a Napa Valley wine, it's because of that TLC.
Mm. Well, are a lot of these practices you're talking about that you follow that are part of Napa Green and fish-friendly farming, are they pretty common in Napa at this point?
They're becoming more and more common. I was talking about the vibe of each group. Mm. Farmers started fish-friendly farming kind of on a multi-county basis. And then Napa Green is run by the Napa Valley Vintners Association. And we're certified under both. And I was involved in both. And the thing I think the key takeaway for the cynics out there is that they are third-party vetted as mm-hmm. well. So we just went through our biannual checkup. And what's really cool about that is that the experts who do that will give you ideas. Okay, you're kind of falling short here. Mm. You're doing really well over here. Have you thought about X, Y, and Z? And the other Napa Green thing that is different than fish-friendly farming is it looks at energy cost and where's your energy coming from? How are you using your energy? How can you reduce it? Hmm. And so, and that can come in many ways, but I wandered off the question.
It's okay. Is Napa Green, is that an actual label that's on the bottle?
You can put it on your bottle if you decide to do it. We have not yet because there have been some challenges to that from the higher up, which is in our case the TTB. So
what is that? TTB?
It is the federal agency that regulates wine labels.
Oh, interesting.
And so we're kind of getting through that, and we've thought about it for our paper labels, but we haven't quite pulled the trigger on it yet. Mm. When we make some changes to our paper labels for other reasons, maybe we'll add it to it. And the reason is it's just the time and effort and cost and to change the label. So when you want to do it, you want to do it once, again, to be effective. So how many people are in Fish Friendly and Napa Green? It is well over 50%, and the vintners are pushing everybody who is a member to be certified Napa Green. And there is a goal to get every vineyard certified voluntarily. And it'll never be a regulatory approach. I think it'll always be a voluntary thing. So there'll be people who don't join, but it's a huge movement. In Napa.
Mm. Do any of the practices that you're talking about that are more, you're doing them for the ecological benefit, the environmental benefit, like the permanent cover crops, things like that, do any of those affect the actual character of the wine?
Yes, emphatically so. To get back to our favorite topic, the cover crop, what you're trying to do with a grapevine is actually limit its yield versus a lot of other crops. You're trying to maximize the yield. You're trying to limit its yield. So how do you do that? You do it with competition for the nutrients in the soil. It's going to be a big thing because we had lots of rain this year, so they're going to grow profusely, and we'll be doing more trimming of the vines this year. But if you have a good cover crop, that's helping soak up excess water. It's creating competition for the nutrients. And I don't know, you'll have some celestial singing or something when you have perfect balance and perfect harmony. But until then, you just have us mere humans trying to figure it out. And so by creating that competition, you're creating more intensity in the remaining grapes. Mm. And in some years, like this year, we may leave a few more grapes on the vine because there's going to be more energy available just because of the profuse year of water. But if there was less and it was more of a normal rainfall year, We may trim more grapes off to create more intensity in the remaining fruit. And so we want smallish clusters relative to what the natural size is with, and what you end up with smaller berries and smaller clusters is a more intense flavor. I mean, everybody's gone to the store and bought some bland tasting juiced up piece of fruit that's really giant in size. And then you have, oh my God, and you're putting your hand in front of your mouth because you're still chewing on some delicious piece of produce that has been handcrafted and it's struggled a little bit and it's more right sized, I guess you could say.
So it's the same idea.
Absolutely.
Well, I think we unfortunately have to wrap up, but thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
I'm just getting warmed up.
Sorry.
But thank you so much.
Where can people find your wines? That's probably maybe a hard question to answer, but...
GambleFamilyVineyards.com. Okay. GambleFamilyVineyards.com. And we are in... beginning to have a presence in the New York area in both restaurants and... and in some wine shops.
Great. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening to the Farm Report on Heritage Radio Network. If you enjoyed the conversation, please subscribe, rate it, and share it. I'll see you next Wednesday.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.